Valid for major life events and reaching financial goals.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. After decades of climbing the corporate ladder, equality issues remain for women in the workforce. Dramatic wage and opportunity gaps remain, not the least of which is the often heard statistic that for every dollar a man makes, women earn 77 cents. Perhaps even more troubling is the fact that research indicates that when women try to negotiate for better and equal pay, they are seen as less likable as individuals and less appealing as colleagues. We've done a lot of programs on this, and that's new information for me. Enter our guest today. She's been dubbed the Wage Gap Warrior. She's also been dubbed by CNN as one of their 10 visionary women. She is Victoria Butson, Executive Director of the Women and Public Policy Program at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government, and she joins us for the hour to talk about all of this and more. Welcome to Charlotte and to the program. You're here under the auspices of Queen's University as part of a conference that's been taking place this week that has been completely sold out, but for which they've already announced next year's dates, which would be March 16th through 18th. Tell us about this conference. What was it about?
Sure, Mike, and thanks for having me on today. So the TWIST conference put on by the McCall School of Business at Queen's University gives women a real opportunity to take a break out of their daily lives and re-envision their own contribution and leadership. It's one of these rare opportunities in life where you get to spend three full days with a group of amazing women and dust off what are the dreams and passions that you have and what are the proactive steps that you can take to go from where you are to where you would ideally be in your career. What does it look like? How do you do it? Who can you journey with? It's really dynamite, and we had such spectacular event so far and are already looking forward to next year.
And next year you can get information about that, or at least you have to pre-register through the McCall School of Business at Queen's University of Charlotte, and you can get that information on their website very easily. Now, prior to your current position as Executive Director for Women and Public Policy at Harvard, you served in the U.S. State Department, the Steering Committee for Women in Public Service Project, first under Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, later under Secretary of State John Kerry. You also advised the Obama White House on gender gap issues. You certainly have a professional expertise and interest in this, but I would wager that you have a very personal interest and expertise in this as well. When did that begin for you?
You know, for me, I've always looked at the world and thought it unusual that our world is so divided in terms of roles by whether we were a girl or a boy or a man or a woman. And I can remember being a kid and thinking, how odd that as girls we could play field hockey but not football. And it just seemed like an unusual way to break the world down. No more sensical to me than if we decided all the kids with blonde hair would play field hockey and all the kids with brown hair would play football. And as I grew, I thought it only more so. And it was really clear to me that whether it's here in the U.S. or abroad, giving each person the opportunity to fully actualize themselves and fully contribute to society would matter, not just for them or their families or communities, but much more broadly.
This is kind of a little off the topic, but you brought up football. Knowing what we know about football today, it's a good thing that you didn't end up playing football, don't you think?
Well, it certainly is. If I was going to get repeated hits to the head, it seems to,
you
to
be
not be something.
Here.
You know, when I grew up, when those things happened, one was told to shake it off. And I think, I guess, our science is catching up with us that is no longer the way to go with such things.
But Title IX addressed some of those issues in terms of athletics, particularly at the high school and college level. But your focus has been on women in the workplace and the opportunity and the wage gaps that exist for women still to this day. In the workplace. And we'll talk about some of these things that I didn't know until yesterday. When women go in and ask for a raise, they seem less likable. I mean, that's just alarming to me, actually. You've been described as the lead warrior in fighting this wage gap. I'm not sure who called you that, but that's what I've read everywhere I've read about you. Who do you engage in this battle as a warrior?
Well, what's so fantastic is there's a real broad cadre of people who are interested in getting this right. And we have partners, everyone from Mayor Marty Walsh in Boston to his predecessor, Mayor Menino. We see all kinds of individuals throughout the policy world who want to make sure that we can close the gap. And one of the things I'd like to think about is, though people often note or herald our difficulty that this gap compared to the white male dollar, white women are making 77 or 78 cents on the dollar. But I like to think of it as wage gaps. Mm-hmm. Asian American women are making 87 cents compared to the white male dollar. African American women are making 63 cents. And I would ask our listeners today to think about where in your house you are when you sit and pay bills and envision literally sitting at that desk or your kitchen table. And imagine as an African American woman making 63 cents on the dollar, or a Native American woman making 60 cents on the dollar, or a Hispanic woman making 53 cents on the dollar, and the difference that that would create for you and your family.
Now, I have slightly different figures from you on those. I had 77 cents for women for every dollar earned by a man. I have 66 cents for African-American women and 56 cents for Latinas. Where are these numbers coming from? Because they're all slightly different. They're off by a couple cents here or there. Where are they coming from?
Sure, and that's a really good question. There's a number of different places that one can pull this type of data and assess it, and one can look at it nationally. One can look at it regionally. One can break it down and also look at it by field. And what we find is what's interesting about gaps is there's some problems you can inoculate yourself from. And you can think, well, if I get a really good education, I can make sure I'm never in that situation. But interestingly, it's
not true.
Not true here, Mike. You're exactly right. This is one of these situations where the higher a level of education that a woman's attained, the more likely the gap is to grow rather than shrink. And people always wonder, well, why?
Is that because people with higher levels of education tend to move up the ladder in the workforce, and the higher you go on the ladder in the workforce, there's just a greater disparity? Is that what's happening here?
Well, there's greater discretion. And if you think of it, when you're a line worker or you're a tip worker or you're in a situation where you're working on an hourly wage, there's going to be very little difference in what you're going to make compared to the person next to you, whether you're looking at it male.
Why?
Because there's constraints in the system and there's very little discretion that a manager can apply for what they're going to pay.
When you're making minimum wage, that's the minimum wage.
That's the minimum wage.
It doesn't matter what gender you are.
That's right. So if you're working at McDonald's or you're working at another type of place where the entry-level employee makes a certain salary, as you said, minimum wage or a dollar more, there's very little discretion. The manager can't exercise their own judgment on what they're going to pay someone. And what we find is we see implicit and explicit bias. We see differences in what people pay when there's large amounts of discretion.
But now when we go back to these differences in what white women make mm-hmm. versus men, 77 cents on the dollar, whatever figure we want to put
sure.
on these, African Americans make less, Latinas make still less.
That's right.
What's going on here? Is this gender bias? Is it racism? Is it a combination of the two? Is it something else at work here?
You know, there's a number of different factors. It is a combination of the two, and sometimes people use the term intersectionality. It's the place where different things cross. One of the things that happens when people are being both hired into jobs and compensation is set is we tend to value most the employee who's the most likely person in that role. If you're looking at engineers, if the most likely engineer is a white middle-aged man, then the most likely person to be hired into that role is someone who fits that norm. And one of the things that we find is when we look at STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and math, those are the high wage fields, and those are really growing both in how large a segment of jobs is taken up in that field and also growing in terms of wages. And we're still seeing, so one factor is fewer women are going in to the STEM fields, and we could talk about why that is. In addition, what we also see is that as we have more highly educated women, we again have the problem at the top mm-hmm. where when there's large manager discretion, if you think of in a law firm or if you think in a major corporation, anyone who's VP or above, that salary, there's a huge amount of latitude for what the CEO is going to set that compensation at or what the senior hiring partner or manager is setting that compensation at. And when we look at whole compensation packages, what we repeatedly see is women are usually compensated at the very low end or the middle, you know, the low to middle, and men tend to be compensated at the high end. Now, the other thing that happens when you say, well, why don't women say something? Well, Mike, I'm sure you know women tend not to say something because you don't know. And in this country, wage transparency is something which is still pretty uncommon.
We don't talk about it.
We don't talk about it.
And encouraged not to talk about it.
Absolutely. It's considered impolite.
Right.
But, you know, I think that there needs to be a trade-off between what is polite and what have been our social norms and really getting the data we need to be paid fairly.
I'll bet that you know. You work at Harvard. And this bias doesn't just stop at the doors of academia.
Certainly not.
It continues inside. So do you know how you are compensated in relation to your male colleagues?
You know, it's a great question, and I try to use the tools which we talk about. And let me walk through what they are, because any person can help work towards ensuring that they're paid fairly by doing the following things. One, first, get online if you have access to a computer and begin to look on the internet what are average wages within your field and, if you can, within your specialty. It's nice to look at it by region because housing costs and where you live in the U.S. can make a really large difference in terms of what you're compensated for that area. The next thing to do is to use your social network and to talk to people and try to avoid this pitfall. Most people want to talk with someone who is like them. So if you're a 20-something, if you're a millennial and you're a young woman, you're working in a corporation, you're like, this is great. I'm going to talk with the other five women that I sit with at lunch and I'm going to solve this. What's the problem with that, Mike?
They're on the same playing field. They only know what they know. They're relatively new to the workforce. They don't have a lot of longevity in the workforce, and they only talk to each other.
Mike, you've got it exactly right. So you want to make sure you don't sit down with a group of people who are just like you, whatever that means in your environment, and then ask them the question so you can all validate that you make about the same, yet you're all underpaid and have no way of knowing that. So one of the things which is important for your career generally, but certainly in this area, is you want to talk with people who are further along in their career trajectory. You want to talk with people who aren't like you, whatever that means, both by area of expertise. You certainly ideally would be speaking with both female and male colleagues. And you want a broad set. And you want to talk with people from across the demographic range, which is within your organization. And of course, this is easier said than done, but it's these types of relationships which you're going to want to have both for peer-to-peer sharing of information, for mentorship and sponsorship. Mentorship being someone you can go to and ask a question and you're in the room together talking about the problem or the question. Sponsorship being someone who's higher up in the organization, who speaks well of you and suggests you for opportunities and champions you when you're not in the room. And it's those types of sponsors who can really help, or mentors who can help you get some sense of whether or not you're making a fair wage.
I only have 30 seconds here. If there is, and there is, this societal taboo, you don't talk about what you make, and you certainly don't ask somebody else what they're making, even if they're on the same level with you. So how do you figure it out? If you open yourself up to these conversations with people not like you,
right?
How do you...
You know,
figure it out.
One of the things which we're talking about in the TWIST conference this week is relationship-driven leadership. And it's really about creating these relationships. And we could talk about that more and why it is authentic, meaningful relationship is really the key into helping understand and develop your career in an organization.
Victoria Butson is our guest. She's the Executive Director of Women and Public Policy Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and A Sign of the Times of the Carolinas, a nonprofit organization presenting the evolution of big band today and tomorrow. Tickets available at asignofthetimes.org. And Caremont Health, a leading independent healthcare system distinguished by its care. More information available at caremonthealth.org. Monday on Charlotte Talks, Governor Pat McCrory is the guest. He's had a rocky relationship with fellow GOP lawmakers in the State House. We'll talk about that with the governor and get his take on the impact of changes to how sales taxes are allocated. And we'd like to hear from you. We'll open the phones, and you can send us your comments by Facebook, Twitter, or email at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Join us Monday with the Governor when Charlotte talks at 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, the House passes a budget with no Democratic support. Republican Senator Ted Cruz enters the 26th presidential campaign, and the Army charges Sergeant Bo Bergdahl with desertion.
Join the News Roundup on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest this hour is Victoria Butson, Executive Director of the Women and Public Policy Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. She is the wage gap warrior, and that's what we're talking about. She's here under the auspices of Queen's University of Charlotte. We were talking just before the break about creating relationships that might help close this wage and these opportunity gaps that we're going to talk about this hour. How do creating these relationships help that?
Well, one wants to have a situation where you can have enough trust with colleagues, both within your organization and with similar organizations, but not your own, to get a sense of what is the market bearing for the type of skills that you provide in the position that in which you provide it. And also,
but if women have historically been paid less than men, if you ask that question of a colleague,
you need to ask a colleague who, if you're a young woman, for example, you want to ask a colleague who is a young man who's in a similar position, you ask a colleague who's in a similar position who is not female to ideally get some of that data. But the more people you talk to, the better. And if you can really get data from the field generally, which is readily available on the web to find out what are teachers making or what is it that entry-level first-year law associates are making, you want to have the data. And then we can talk about how what do you do once you have it? Because let's say one is out there and listening today and one says, okay, I have done that and I just found out I'm making 30% lower than the male colleagues in the office. What do you do?
Mm-hmm.
Storming into your manager's office and proclaiming that might not get you the raise that you want. So here are some skills and tools that one can use. So the first is we know from research by Hannah Riley Bowles, who's one of our faculty members, who's our research director up at Harvard University at the Women in Public Policy program. We know that when one is negotiating for salary, when women are asking for a particular amount, they do better if they use what's called a relational script. Bob, if I was asking for a raise from you and I said, Bob, thanks so much for the opportunity for this next promotion, the salary you offered me sounds good, but it's about 10% less than what I think my skills are worth in the marketplace.
That's your opinion, right?
So that's right. And just the way you honed right in on that's my opinion, what we find is women do much better when two things happen.
Okay.
And we're not saying they should need to do this. This is just that the data shows one is more likely to get to the positive outcome with less social backlash if, one, we say something that's relational. Bob, I've really enjoyed being on the team. I so like working together, and I think we could partner effectively with me in this new role. When I look throughout our industry, this role and skills commensurate with mine command about 10% more. Is that something we could make happen together? So I've made the same ask, but I've done it in a way that I'm validating the importance of relationships. And we find that the image that people hold in their mind of how women should behave, that type of ask mirrors it.
What about bringing in personal life? Because, you know, women are sometimes the breadwinners. Women have, and we'll talk a lot about this, women have historically been paid a lot less, which means that Social Security, when it comes in, is going to be coming in at a lower level.
Mike, you are so correct.
So what about saying, you know, thank you for the offer, I really appreciate it, you've recognized my skill set, and I'm flattered, and I really want to do this new job, but the money you're putting on the table here is just not enough because I've got two kids in school, one of them's facing college, et cetera, et cetera. I went to a seminar years ago, which my boss thought was for program directors in radio to teach them to be better program directors, and it ended up being how to negotiate. I don't know why it did, but it just did, and it's stood well the test of time, because the guy said, when you're offered a situation and more money, and you want just slightly more money or even a lot more money, you go back and you say, thank you for the offer. It's very flattering. But, you know, my wife has been really eyeing new drapes for the living room, and she needs a car because she – and I need to get to that level because I just can't do it any other way.
So,
and they understand that. They say bosses understand that.
Well, I think what you're tapping right into is the breadwinner model and who in our society is able to leverage the breadwinner kind of narrative, which is really pervasive in our culture. And you are 100% accurate when you noted that women are often the breadwinner. And what we see is in more than half the families that women are either the primary or a highly significant breadwinner. And what we're finding, you know, even for example.
And do bosses know that? Do they get that?
Well, here's the thing. Whether they know it and get it, I think is also then secondary to what happens if they know it and get it. And what we know from some of our research, for example, is when a woman returns in the workplace after having a child, she is viewed as less engaged and more absent, even when her behaviors are the same. And when a man returns after taking parental leave to the office, he is viewed as – he gets what's called a relational bonus. He is viewed as a more likable guy.
Why? Because he let his wife have a child?
Because he's now a dad.
Oh, he's a daddy.
He's a dad, which makes him a more likable guy. And he's viewed as more engaged and not likely to leave the organization. He's viewed as more committed because of the breadwinner myths and narratives in our society.
How do you change that? Because
how do you change it? It's a great question. Well, one, for the woman who has returned from parental leave into the office, she needs to make sure she does a great job of communicating when she is not in her office. She, her colleagues, her schedule needs to be transparent. So if someone walks by her office and doesn't see Brenda standing at her desk, someone needs to be able to say, Brenda's negotiating a deal down the hall.
Because the assumption is Brenda is at home taking care of the kid.
Some That's exactly right. And if, for example, if Bob leaves a meeting early to go watch their child play soccer, Bob is charming. If Brenda leaves a meeting early to go watch her child play soccer, Brenda is not committed.
Now, where does this come from? Does this come from the fact that still in the upper echelons of an organization, and even in middle management, many of the middle managers are male? They have this collegial bond, this boys' club bond. Is that where it comes from, or is something else at work?
You know, I think that we used to really view that these problems were because of guys and what they did, but the research doesn't bear it out. What the research shows is that we're all pickled in the same brine and that it's really easy to put the cucumber into the brine. I don't know if your grandmother ever did canning and, you know, it is very hard to get the brine out of the pickle. And we are all pickled in our culture. And what happens is we grow up with these myths and narratives and stories where dad is going out and making a paycheck.
Yeah.
And mom is home taking care of the family. And it's a narrative that really applies to very few families that ever really functioned at any point in our society in quite this way. But it's really hard to get that narrative out of our mind.
We have a lot of myths about what America is about and what the American family is about. And many of those myths come from 1950s television. And
they
painted a picture of the family where dad went out. And we had no idea what dad did when he came home. But he was out there every day working with his briefcase. And mom was the homemaker. And that's what America is about. It was never about that. It never really worked that way. But, you know, this is not 1970 when women were just beginning to go into the workforce en masse. It's 40 years, 45, 46 years later. And still we have these same recurrent problems. I mean, we're still fighting the wage gap. Why?
Until we have wage transparency, there's going to be gaps.
And when you say wage transparency, are we supposed to publish what everybody's making?
Until we're in a system where there's transparency, where one knows if they're being underpaid, you know, I think it makes a lot of sense and value that an employer would be able to justify who they pay, how much, and for what. For example, I manage a team of people. It is important to me that individuals understand what steps and actions they would need to pursue in order to grow in those roles and in the organization. And so transparency is a big thing. Often women are significantly underpaid because people are unaware. And note, I don't think that most people mean to underpay segments of their workforce by demographic. What happens is we all have these implicit biases, and then they play out in these small ways. And usually whatever you're making is really pegged from your first entrance into the organization. It's a very common thing that one will say, what did you make at your last job? And so that we end up with a snowball effect of when women are paid less initially, it continues. And women tend to negotiate that first offer less because they properly assess the social backlash that comes from that negotiation. Mm-hmm. And what we need to do is to try to help change those norms.
And on the other hand, you almost began this conversation by saying that you have been working with people who really want to change the paradigm. You mentioned the mayor of Boston, and there are people in industry who are on board with this because you work with some significant companies.
That's right.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but is Microsoft one of them?
You know, I'll tell you, within the Women in Public Policy program, we have really wonderful relationships with corporations on our board, including Walmart, ExxonMobil, McDonald's, Credit Suisse, Swiss Re, Zurich Insurance. And if you think about the size of workforces and those types of companies, that the more people understand how to get it right, because every company wants to hire and retain the best employees and the best talent.
So if there are people on board who want to do this, why isn't it being done?
Why is it so hard?
Yes.
So I'll tell you, the larger the company or government, the more likely they are to get it right. If you look across the United States, the city which has the smallest wage gap is Washington, D.C. And the reason is because in the federal government, you have very clear paradigms of what it is that you make and how what grade you're considered in and then what the salary range is.
And it's genderless. If
yes.
if you're a clerk, you're a I used to know the government grading system, but you're a G5 or whatever, G2, and that's what you make, whether you're a guy or a woman.
Exactly. And so what we find is when we look at it by systems – by job role as opposed to by individuals, we're much more likely to get it right. As human beings, the way our mind works, we take all the information and experiences and data we've ever received, and then we categorize it and code it, and we use it to organize our world. But what happens with that, because a lot of what we're taking in, you talked about 1950s TV, a lot of what we synthesize is in essence misinformation. But it's all part of how we code. And then what happens is these implicit, not on purpose, ways we see the world then get played out in our decision making.
In companies where women hold the upper hand because they hold the upper level positions, like for instance, when I think Carly Fiorina ran, was it Hewlett-Packard? Did this wage gap and these opportunity gaps begin to disappear? Did women suddenly start making equal pay?
Well, here's the great news, Mike. People like to sometimes think that the problem is the guys. The problem is the culture, not the guys. Men and women as hiring officers are equally likely, equally likely to underpay women. And again, it's because we're all taking in the same cultural information. So this isn't a problem that gets solved just by having women at the top of the management tree. This is a problem that really gets solved institutionally by making sure the management structures and the hiring and promotion structures are designed in such a way that there's lesser ability for people to have discretion in ways that bias can be produced.
When I first got into the workforce, and I don't know that this is true, it's purely anecdotal, but I remember hearing several times that, you know, if you get married and have kids, you'll make more money because they'll see a need to pay you more because you have to support your family. That's that breadwinner concept. And you have discovered that women with children earn roughly 10 to 15% than working women without children.
That's right.
Why doesn't the same attitude exist for women who have kids as it does for men who have kids?
And it's a great question, particularly, for example, in Boston, we are almost in a situation where the majority of single-family head of households with kids you know, are headed by women, and nearly the majority of children in Boston will grow up in a single family head of household home. So note that this is often a situation where a woman isn't just a breadwinner, but the breadwinner. Mm-hmm. But the cultural norms don't translate that way for women, where people viewed a man taking care of his family as the primary breadwinner to be a cultural archetype that was worth supporting and rewarding. Mm-hmm. That was something that deserved more money. That hasn't translated in any way to women's experience in the workplace. And as you cite, the opposite is true, which creates a really interesting paradigm. And then map that onto something else. The majority of people in the United States to get high school, associates, college, and postgraduate degrees are female.
Yes.
So our talent pool is swinging female. And as a society, our ability within our business models to hire, promote, and retain the best talent is going to depend on our ability to get over some of these biases.
Yeah.
And to be able to effectively reap the benefit that we've already made as a society by educating women.
One of the few sectors of the economy that seems to be layoff-proof is medicine. And on Tuesday, both the Associated Press and ABC News released information that in a female-dominated field like nursing, male nurses make about $5,000 a year more than their female counterparts, which amounts to about $150,000 over the course of a career. This has persisted over 20 years. This is not new. But this is a female-dominated field. How can this be?
What is so fascinating is when women are in male-dominated fields, they're paid less. When men are in female-dominated fields, they're paid more. And the reason is cultural bias. That, again, men are prized for going into a field which is viewed as non-traditional, such as teaching or nursing, in a way that women don't get that benefit when they go in apprenticeship programs and work in unions, whether that's plumbing or electrician or so forth. And I want to follow back to a really important point that you raised earlier, which is how then all of these wage gaps really then tie into what retirement looks like.
Yes.
The most likely poor person in the United States is an elderly white woman who wasn't poor in her working years and didn't think she was going to be poor. And I chair the Commission on the Status of Women in Massachusetts. I'm an appointee of our former governor, Deval Patrick. And a woman said something at one of the hearings that we had on Cape Cod that I thought really resonated, and it codified an image of what happens with women all over the United States. She said, "I'm poor now, and I had retired thinking I'd have enough, and I don't. I was a good wife. I was a good mother. I was a good employee. I played by the rules. I did everything I was supposed to do. But now there isn't enough, and no one will hire me." Mm. And that is an incredibly common experience that women have. And what happens is when people aren't making enough money and are making, you know, what we talked about is anything from 87 cents to 53 cents.
Let me stop you because we have to take a break, and we'll come back to that in just a couple. Because this is a societal problem with long-lasting consequences. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Culture and Heritage Museums, presenting Sarah DeRose, an award-winning singer-songwriter who blends contemporary folk, Americana, and roots music. April 3rd at the McKelvey Center. Tickets at chmuseums.org. It's the Friday News Roundup today on the Diane Rehm Show, and at 10 o'clock, a panel of journalists will join Diane for analysis of the week's top national news stories. The House passes a budget with no Democratic support, Republican Senator Ted Cruz enters the 2016 presidential race, and the Army charges Sergeant Bo Bergdahl with desertion. That's the News Roundup on the Diane Rehm Show at 10, after Charlotte Talks, here on 90.7 WFAE. We want to remind you that you can join Mike Collins next Thursday night, April 2nd, at the Evening Muse in NOTA for a special musical edition of Charlotte Talks with Charlotte band Sinners and Saints and local music industry experts. That taping starts at 7, and we'd like you to be there. More info at WFAE.org. Every day on Morning Edition, it's the news you can't do without.
This morning, we've been looking at what's happening.
There's conservatism, libertarianism, environmentalism, religion.
We're not props. We're just everyday people.
The crowd, the joy, the sense of hope.
Historic.
Listen to the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Catch Morning Edition weekdays from 5 until 9 here on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and we're talking today to Victoria Butson, who is in town because of Queen's University of Charlotte and their TWIST conference, which will be held again next year in March 16th through 18th. But she's also the executive director of the Women in Public Policy Program at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. We're talking about one area of her expertise, which is the wage and opportunity gap that women have historically and continue to face in the workforce, which has long-term implications for the economy at large, particularly as boomers, who, and many of the boomers are women who have been working for years, go into retirement. And as you mentioned, that the most likely candidate to be poor is an elderly white woman who was a good mother, a good homemaker, a good employee, who thought they'd put enough aside for retirement and did not. And as you mentioned, at one of these conferences on Cape Cod, a woman stood up and said all of that, and said now she needs the money, she's poor, and no one will hire her. And Social Security for women who have been underpaid for their entire lifetimes is lower, what a surprise, than it would be had they been properly paid.
And it's a really significant issue. And the first thing I would say is each person who is listening should really think about how they do their financial planning and modeling to make sure that they'll have enough. For women to understand that though, you know, when Social Security was developed, we had very few women who served in the Congress. And people in no way meant to create a two-tiered system. But because women tend to outlive their male counterparts, they need more money because it's a longer time horizon. Mm-hmm. They didn't think about how women are very likely to be unpartnered, whether that's because they have chosen not to marry, whether it's because of divorce or death of a spouse, mm-hmm. that women's jobs generally are less pensionable, and that women make less for doing the same jobs, and women have spent a lot more time out of the workforce to care both for dependents, whether that's kids, and for elderly parents. And you put all that together, and you end up with women not at all having an equivalent social safety net.
Right. Surely this has to change. Now, women, at least in North Carolina, and I'm assuming that it's probably this way in much of the country, women make up the majority of the voting population. Most of the registered voters in North Carolina are women. I think it's like 57% are women. And yet they are still woefully underrepresented in the legislature, in other elected bodies, and in Congress. And when men are asked if they think they are qualified to run for office, most of them say yes. Women, not so sure. So it's not going to really change until women think, yes, I am, and I'm going to run, and I'm running, and I've won, and I'm in office, right?
Absolutely right. Women are the majority of voters throughout the United States, both in terms of those who are registered to vote and also in terms of those who actually then go out and follow through and vote. Let's also note that—
Are they voting in their economic self-interest?
I think women consistently demonstrate that the top issue is the economics. Women are very savvy. They vote their interests. Women are not a monolithic block. Mm-hmm. So it also is, you know, which women. We know that— single moms tend to be late-breaking voters. They have a lot. They're a big portion of the swing vote, which means you've got to make sure you're speaking their language, talking about their issues, doing so right before the election. But what we know is women do vote their interests. And the other thing to remember is that women are 51% of the population. So we're the majority. We're not an interest group. We are the majority. We also make the majority of purchasing decisions in the United States, including car purchasing decisions. More than 60% of the cars purchased, even—
And real estate.
You bet.
Women buy the house.
So we're in a situation where women have the pieces in the mosaic to be very well heard, but that isn't fully actualized. And it's about how do we create a situation where women's voices and needs are being better listened to and then fulfilled, not just for them, but all of North Carolina will be better served when the issues of each North Carolinian is represented well. And it's very difficult, even for good, well-meaning people, to make effective policy for people who've lived a life that is not quite like theirs.
Right.
And encouraging women to run and asking a competent woman you know to run. Do not let a week go by that you do not turn to some woman who you know is smart and capable and dynamic without saying, we could really use your voice, whether that's in the Senate, whether that's in the House, whether it's in the state legislature, whether it's on a community board. But much changes when one is actually sitting at the table making the choices.
Your research says it indicates a significant amount of bias in the workplace, which is why women aren't promoted as frequently, which is why they don't make as much. And you say that the amount of bias can be predicted by how much bias there is in society against women. Are you talking about here in the United States? Are you talking about the industrialized world, the Western world, or other parts of the world?
Well, what we know, for example, when we're looking at the wage gap in the United States, that roughly there's roughly 7 cents that can't be accounted for by any type of life choice, i.e. by whether or not one had kids, by how many hours you spend with FaceTime in the office, by which field you went into, whether you went into a STEM field, for example, mm-hmm. that's more likely to be lucrative, level of education. And there certainly are life choices that will make a difference in what your compensation is. If one is pursuing a degree in the STEM field, if one does take the steps to make sure that one has equal amount of face time and is in the office, which is still a pretty prized value in many different corporate environments, you can manage to close part of that gap. But there's still a part of the gap that isn't accounted for through any choice. And it's that involuntary wage gap, those involuntary gaps where there's no way that an individual can fix it, that we most need to focus on. That's what we need to change.
How much of this lag, this gap, is due to the fact that women were late to the game? They were late to the employment game because it was traditional for women to stay at home, not work, raise the family, cook the meals, clean the house. How much of it has to do that they were late to the game of politics because it's only been 100 years that women in America have had the vote? In our culture, they have not. They're late to the game in being equal status with men because women were second-class citizens for a good part of American history. How much of it has to do with that women are still today playing catch-up?
You know, I would say that women were at the game and standing there.
They were the power behind the throne, but they
weren't
recognized.
But people wouldn't let them on the field.
Right, exactly.
So what I would say is, as a society, what we've done is handicap ourselves in the global race by not enabling our full team to get on the field.
Same argument made with racism.
So 51% of our talent force, 51% of our potential isn't fully actualized. Mm-hmm. Now, we have, as we talked about, the majority of people receiving an education today are female, which means rather than playing catch-up, we're in a situation where the majority of our graduating talent is female. So who is playing catch-up is hiring entities and officers and our institutions and being able to see and identify the talent in front of them. Mm-hmm. The other thing we have to think about is the majority of our major cities across the United States, if they are not already, over the next decade, become majority-minority. So when we think about who is our educated workforce, who is our labor force, who is our talent, what that looks like is significantly shifting. And our challenge and our opportunity is to get it right in assessing and utilizing the best talent that we have. Now, when we talk about politics, I mean, the country as it, you know, the country was founded in 1776. 1789 is when the House and Senate as we see it today became codified. As you noted, it wasn't until 1920 we got the vote. Between all that time and today, the best we've ever done is 20% in the U.S. Senate and a little less in the House. And when we think about how robust and diverse our nation is, you know, we've only had a couple women of color ever serve in the Senate. Mm-hmm. And we could talk about why it's so important for equality, but let's just talk about it practically. Equality is important, but if we're going to get it right, and note, when we do national policy, when we don't get it right, it's extraordinarily expensive. The Affordable Care Act, its first draft, for example, didn't have pap smears and mammograms as mandatory coverage items. It is a regularized and routine part of every woman's health care, mammograms over the age of 40, and 1 in 8 women in the United States get breast cancer. So when we have a mismatch between what our life looks like and what the policy is, it costs the nation a fortune. Mm-hmm. You think of what it costs to diagnose and treat early stage cancers versus late stage. Everyone has a stake in policymakers getting it right. And one of the most effective ways to do that is to have a legislative body and governmental bodies that reflect the population. It's a pretty easy fix.
Right. How much of it also has to do with something we really have not talked about? There was this whole conversation years ago about women having it all. They wanted it all. They wanted the house. They wanted the kids. They wanted the husband. They wanted their life at home. They wanted to be in, they wanted to be successful in business, and they wanted to be able to find this balance, which is almost impossible, I think, to find. But you talk about work-life balance, suggesting that women set their priorities and ask themselves how they might construct a life that meets those priorities. You say the role of employers should be to provide a flexible set of options for employees so that they can balance best at home. If that happened, it seems, that would be a major paradigm shift. How can companies compete against each other if they have to also be worried about your, not just your woman, your man's, your their male or female's work-life balance?
Well, what we find is we want our employees to be highly engaged. You'll often hear discussion of engagement surveys. You want both your employee present, but you also want your employee effectively, mentally, or physically fully present and getting the job done.
Because it's the impression by a lot of people that women are at some point in their career are going to want to go and have a child.
What I would say is people at some point in their career, you know, many are the majority of the workforce at some point chooses to have a child. And here in the United States, we're the only industrialized nation in the world that has no mandatory type of paid leave. We have no statutorily based paid leave, whether that's sick time, whether that's maternity or paternity leave. And creating effective mechanisms for parental leave, effective mechanisms for paid sick days, gives our workforce the ability to meet their needs at home and at work.
So it cannot be argued then, can it, that we would be putting ourselves at an internationally competitive disadvantage if we offered these things to the American workforce? Because you're saying it's already available elsewhere.
Yeah, no, it's definitely available elsewhere. And what we see is that the most innovative companies and some of our largest companies already know that they save millions by creating situations where people can work from home, that by creating flexible work schedules and tiered schedules, you can have coverage for your customer service. You can have coverage for all the types of interface that run 24/7, 365 by offering people flexibility. And presuming that what one worker needs is what another worker needs sometimes misses the opportunity that the company can have in being more competitive. We've seen tremendous leadership by the Obama administration. They had their Working Families Summit, which took place in June, highlighting best practices and the ability for companies to create dynamic opportunities to improve the bottom line by creating flexibility in the workforce. One of the things that we want to do is retain our talent. And one of the ways of doing that is creating a situation where people can effectively manage at home so they can be at work.
I know that this is not just an American problem, that there are issues with women in the workforce, particularly in the third world, that are egregious. But are there countries, are there areas of the world that have done a particularly good job of addressing these wage and opportunity gaps for women?
You know, one of the things that we've seen is in some nations such as the Netherlands, when one takes parental leave, there's a chunk which is designated that the woman can take, and there's a chunk that's designated that the man can take. And if the man takes paternity leave, then they get an additional amount of leave. But creating governmental incentives so that there's opportunities for early care where men can be involved. You know, what also happens is, you know, sometimes the guys get a bad rap in all this. And these are much more complex issues where it takes both men and women and societal challenges. And sometimes the guys want to take some of that time. So on the you know, paternity leave, for example, and their companies don't offer it,
yeah,
which creates a situation where then the woman is home in the out of the workforce for a longer period because there's not parity for what's available to men.
So in this environment that we have politically right now, where the free market seems to be the golden beast, can you do this? Can you accomplish this in a free market, or do you need the government to come in and set some rules?
Well, we already have rules that it's already against the law to underpay a class of individuals. So what's nice is we already have statutes in place, such as the Lilly Ledbetter Act, right, which was going back to the 1963 law, which indicates that you have to pay men and women an equal wage for the same job. But what we see now is the ability to both incentivize. In Boston, for example, the work we've done with the Women's Workforce Council of Mayors Menino and then Walsh, we have scores of businesses and some of the largest businesses who have signed on that they're going to take three action steps to help close the wage gap. That work was then picked up by Governor Deval Patrick and the Successful Women, Successful Families Task Force, and we have more than 150 companies that are working to close the wage gap within their companies. Mm-hmm. Many people want to get this right. People want to ensure that their workforce is going to stay with them, that they've invested in, and they're looking for the tools and strategies to do it.
And one of the tools and strategies that you recommend that we don't have time to talk about now is for companies to conduct a wage audit to see what they're paying individuals for the same job and to look at the hiring and promotional practices within their own companies. Do you find that? I don't have time to answer the question, so I won't ask the question. Hopefully that works. Our guest, Victoria Butson, Executive Director of the Women and Public Policy Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Thank you very much for the hour.
Thanks so much, Mike.